Blog Talk Radio. Is an integral part of our democratic organization, a very natural and obvious structure. Community control of police is against the organization of government control from the top down. Jim Crow is not dead, but indeed alive and well and growing by the minute. The question for our next broadcast is, do we have the emotional capacity to deal with this reality? This week, we have a full menu, and we will be gauging our time accordingly to each speaker because our plate is really full. We have quite a banquet of enlightenment for you this evening. This week, we will examine the 2016 election campaign. Hillary Clinton Democrats think they can run without the left. They feel we are so afraid of Donald Trump that we will vote for anybody to avoid the new Nazis. But we won't. We have our own agendas. Free all political prisoners, convict killer cops, etc. However, if we do indeed have this as an agenda, then it is time to walk the talk. Ralph Pointer. In addition to this, we have a special discussion which will be led by a panelist member, Dick Minnelli, Larry Pinkney, Len Stewart, Joel Myers, and Ralph again, concerning this statement that most people in the world today agree that the best form of government is a democracy. What that term means to them is not always clear, since it has two conflicting senses. It can mean the fundamental principles of proper government that were stated by leftist thinkers before that revolution, or it can mean the type of electoral government that elitists or selfish rightists established after it. This term has been dichotomous in this way ever since that revolution, because as our dictionary show, it refers to both a leftist and rightist point of view. And finally, we will be turning the mic for a few moments to our distinguished guest, Tom Syracuse of the New York City Manhattan Green Party, and he will be discussing the history of the use of police forces in our culture and in the black community. So with this introduction, the discussion of the Hillary Clinton Democrat issue, the discussion of the real meaning of human rights and the meaning of the police and their role in history, I would like to turn it over to our incredible facilitator for this evening and that very erudite, educated, revolutionary, Ralph Pointer. Ralph Pointer, are you in the house?
Yes, I am, buddy, and thank you so much for that introduction. And without going into what we're going to discuss tonight, I will begin the program the way we always begin, with what I believe. The overriding element in every situation or circumstance in a black life is racism. Birth, elementary school, housing, health, food, and etc. Black lives have never mattered except during slavery and other circumstances where money is being made by our labor for others. The modern death penalty, 80% black, moved lynching indoors. The police, as the army of occupation, have moved lynching outdoors again. And the lynch mob is the racist system, including the courts and the media. And because the lives of our heroes and sheroes who once protected us in our communities do not matter to us, the people, our political prisoners are now dying in captivity. They are tortured and isolated. Only armed struggle can recreate our image in our own minds as well as the minds of others. Wake up. Now is the time. And so, without going so much into anything that you have discussed, I'm going to turn the program over to you, Betty, to introduce our next guest.
I thank you, Brother Ralph, and I want to acknowledge that we have another illustrious member of the Green Party with us tonight, and that's Sister Colia Clark. And I do believe we have Brother Tom, who's standing by, Brother Myers, Brother Larry Pinckney, and I'm assuming that Sister Lynn Stewart is also going to be a guest speaker this evening. So without further ado, Brother Ralph, I'd like to have Larry Pinckney give us the usual update on Reverend Pinckney, and start us off this evening, and then we will immediately turn the mic over to Brother Minnelli to start our discussion. And I want everybody to be aware that we have a full house, and many of our guest speakers have come prepared to give us a little background history tonight. So, Brother Larry Pinckney, are you ready to start?
Yes, I am, and thank you very much. As always, I extend my love and my strength to you, Sister Betty Davis, to Sister Lynn Stewart, and, of course, to Brother Ralph Pointer. Let me be very succinct and to the point. Reverend Edward Pinckney remains in prison, and appeal, standing bond appeal has been filed with the court in Michigan, the appellate court. And for anyone, because in the interest of time, I want to be very brief, for anyone who would like additional information, please simply go to, just Google this, the Campaign of Terror Against African Americans. That can be found in Global Research. I repeat, the Campaign of Terror Against African Americans. The article is written by Aboyomi Azikiwe, and it is an excellent article. Please read it. It will update you totally and completely. The other article can be found, and by the way, that article came out today, August 4th. The other article that I'd like to draw everyone's attention to is in the Worker's World. The name of the article is Appeal Filed by Reverend, or for Reverend Pinckney. It's by David Soule. It came out on July 23rd, 2015. So in the interest of time, I'm just going to stop there. I want to thank you all. Let's remember all of our political prisoners. I had the opportunity to speak with two political prisoners that I have grown to know well, one who spent 44 years in prison, that's Eddie Conway, Brother Eddie, the other who spent 30 years in prison, and that's Robert King Wilkerson. Their attitude is the same as ours. We must fight, we must struggle, we must free all of our political prisoners. I'm going to stop right there. Again, much love to all of you.
Thank you, Brother Larry Pinckney. I just want to remind you that we need you to hang in there. For those of you who don't know, Brother Larry Pinckney is an incredible scholar and author, and if you Google him, several of his articles dealing with our struggle and our country and the international world scene will emerge. So we would definitely be needing your expertise. We hope you will hang in there. Brother Ralph, you got it.
Yes, I was going to say thank you, Larry. And later on when we bring Lynn Stewart on, we're going to maintain our continuity in focusing on political prisoners. We have new developments, interesting and wonderful developments on the work we have been doing for political prisoners, and Lynn will give us an update. Brother Minnelli, are you with us?
Ralph, I'm just not sure. You know, you asked me to begin our discussion on solutions, and so I jotted some ideas down. Now I think it makes a pretty nice little article. Oh, Betty, I've timed it. It's only 9 minutes, but I don't know if it's appropriate at this stage in the program. I would like to read it because, and by the way, Betty, thank you for quoting some lines from my book on democracy. I have elaborated a little bit on that in this short paper. But if you want me to start, and you're going to start a discussion, then I'm perfectly happy to go ahead with the reminder that my perspective is different because I've really thought these things out from another angle, as I explain in this point. Do you want me to read it or not? It's about 9 minutes long.
Okay.
I would prefer that you... Go ahead, Brother Ralph.
If you would like to hold for a few minutes, I will ask Lynn Stewart to give us an update on what's happening or what work we have been doing on political prisoners and the outcome.
Yeah, that's what I thought was best because, you know, this is like if this engenders some discussion, then we have a little time at the end to have the discussion after the ideas have been expressed. They are, in some respects, very new ideas, and people will have a point of view on them. So that's okay. It's all based on my book, Human Nature. So, you know, and as I said, 9 minutes and then about 5 or 10 minutes of discussion after that would be very nice if people wanted to join in. But, you know, we can put it off. We should put it off to the end because you got a lot going on in the program.
Okay, great. Well, Lynn, Sister Lynn, would you like to give us a little of what we've been doing over the week?
I'm more than happy to do that, and I'm happy to be on the program. Hi, Betty. Hi, everybody out there in Radio Land. I just want to say that there were two important events this week. One was a meeting that was called by the Center for Constitutional Rights, and they called a meeting of connection with Black Lives Matter to discuss the issue of law and what can be done. And it was extremely well attended. It must have been 700 or 800 people attending this conference at Riverside Church and Columbia Law School, and basically the discussions, everything from how does a lawyer represent a movement person to how does a movement lawyer represent a person who's been impoverished. And we had great discussion, but the best thing about the conference was the mood and that the people attending, mostly people of color and women. It was very highly populated women. And that this conference closed on Saturday, and in its closing, it adopted what we think is a very forward-looking statement. And I'm going to read the statement, and I'm going to add a the statement they adopted was, there is no option off the table to rid this nation of white supremacy. And I would only add to that, there is no option except compromise, appeasement, or surrender. Those are not options. We must fight on. And in that line, and for our political prisoners who are getting attention finally that they so richly deserve, being the heroes of our time, and we realize that in the events that have been held around Kwaku Odinga lately, that here he is walking among us, this tremendous man who was part of the escape of Sada Shakur and the reason why she is living healthily and happily in Cuba. But we have Ray Lavasser, another political prisoner out of jail, came out and proposed to the Guild that a new committee be formed, and that committee is to support U.S.-held political prisoners. And the plan is that there would be a Guild member for every political prisoner, and this would be done pro bono, meaning no fees attached. It is a nascent, it is a beginning thing, but it has been greeted with great approval by people who have heard about it and want to become part of it. And the National Lawyers Guild National Executive Committee reached a consensus to create this committee, and we, of course, are going to follow up on it completely. But so far, the reaction to the notion that no political prisoner should be without a lawyer, and that these lawyers would handle not just perhaps appeals or maybe something in connection with health, but would handle anything that affected that political prisoner. And this one-on-one approach is very important. Also, these lawyers would be schooled to work with defense committees. And I just want to end by saying it's a very positive step forward. People who are interested can contact Ralph, can contact Betty, can contact Ben Evans at bencevans@gmail.com. We really want this to take off, and it will take off at the Guild Conference, which we held in October. I thank you all. I'm going to get off because I know that there are people amping at the bit to get on this air. So let me not be wordy, and thank you very much for your time, and good night.
All right.
Thank you.
You should understand that that leaves room for every person on this line and for every person interested in progress to be involved in this overdue movement of bringing together all elements of our movement to free our political prisoners. And with that said, I'm going to turn it back to you, Betty. To pick the next
I just
step.
Want to give an update. I attended the move. Conference in Philadelphia this weekend on Saturday, which was the solidarity with the Move 7, because two have now been killed through medical neglect in the death camps. And it was a very powerful program, and the Move second and third generation are strong, and they are prepared to pick up the gauntlet to fight for their political prisoners. I give special shout out to Suzanne Ross and Ramona Africa for the way they promoted, conducted, and made this program such a success. Those of you who are familiar with the Move 9 situation, you know it's the bombing of Philadelphia and the deliberate fire, letting it burn in the fire. You would be heartened and encouraged to see the second and third generation raise their fist in defiance, ready to pick up the gauntlet to fight for liberation. With that said, I would like to give a few moments to one of my comrades and warriors in the struggle for freedom and liberation, and I'm referring to Brother Tom Syracuse, who has some information he would like to share in line with Mr. Poynter's credo and our sixth episode of analyzing giving an anatomy of oppression. And we'll follow with, I believe, Sister Clark, Collier Clark is on the line as well. So, Brother Tom Syracuse, are you ready to enlighten us this evening?
Yes.
Hello. Can you give us a little bit of your background, Tom?
Well, I became interested in the Green Party during the campaign of Al Lewis, who ran for governor. It was obvious to me by then that the political establishment, the Democrat and Republican parties, were both controlled by big money interests, and even though the Democrats have posed from time to time to be on the side of working class people, that this was just not true. And I became the chair of the Manhattan Green Party, I'd say about 5 or 6 years ago. We have a new chair now, Daniel Vila. He mounted a campaign against Charlie Rangel and got 13% of the vote without hardly any money, but just getting out on the street and raising issues such as the one that you've been talking about, the problem of police brutality, what the police are really about, and the problem of racism and classism in the United States. And I want to thank Ralph and Betty for letting me say a few words on this program. We decided to put out an anti-racist, pro-working class newsletter, and it's just about finished. And one of the main articles, written mainly by Daniel Vila, the new chair of the Manhattan Greens, is entitled "The Origins of the Modern Day Police Force." I urge people to read this. It goes all the way back to the use of private police during the colonial period in order to keep indigenous people under control, and also the use of private police during the period of slavery and also after, to keep the African-American population under control. This was done without having to organize a large publicly supported bureaucratic police department like we have today, mainly because of the racism that existed in this country. The majority of the whites in this country, including the working class, were perfectly comfortable with the oppression of the indigenous and black populations. But in the 19th century, with the arrival of more and more European working class immigrants into the cities of the United States, having private groups, police, the growing conflict, class conflict that was that existed in this country, and it just wasn't enough. So the problem was certainly the ruling class was not about to recruit police from their own class, from their own children. So the problem was, how do you convince a small segment of the working class, namely the white working class, to serve the interests of the ruling elite against their own people? How do you do this? How do you organize these large police departments like we have now, and until recently made largely up of the white working class themselves, to suppress their own class? Of course, now we have many, many more people of color in the police department, so the same problem arises. How do you convince people to oppress their own class? And one of the ways is to give them certain privileges so that the police people are, and the police department are given certain benefits. They are paid a much better wage and given a much better pension than their counterparts within their own class. And they're organized as a military unit in order to maintain this idea that they are privileged, they are different, and the people that they oppress are not really the same as they are. That these people are almost like aliens, that they're troublemakers and drunkards, and they're dangerous to the social order. And so far, this has worked. But more and more people are becoming aware of the true origins and the true purpose of the police. And that is to protect the interests of the power elite. There's
okay,
nothing
so
to
Tom,
do.
I have to advise you that our time is moving on, but I think some people want to respond to you, so I need you to try and wind it up and give some of our panelists a chance to respond to you.
Okay, I recommend two researchers in particular. Victor Kappeler's Kappeler book on A Brief History of Slavery and the Origins of American Policing, and Gary Potter, Potter, A History of Policing in the United States.
Well, thank you for that, Tom. They're very much appreciated. And when people read these two books, they're going to understand where political prisoners come from. And they are those people who fight for justice and try to change the system, but their fight is criminalized. But you can get more of it when you get into details on those two books. And there are many other books written. But thanks again. Look forward to hearing more of your newspaper as your fight to make America more green and more just. Look forward to hearing from you again next week. Betty, you have our next guest.
Once again, Betty, we want to thank Tom Syracuse. I thank you. And we're going to ask Sister Collier Clark, who has run for many positions in our city as a member of the Green Party, if she would come on board. We want to advise her that we do have a time limit because we have a discussion that will take place after this that will be at least 15 to 20 minutes long. So, Sister Clark, are you in the house?
I'm in the house, Betty. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Loud and clear.
Well, I want to say hello to everyone. Extend my congratulations to you and Raph and Lynn for being able to get this project off the ground. It is what we need. And I'm just listening here for the first time because I've been struggling to get on. So at last I'm on. I'm in. And I want to say to Brother Pinckney that my heart and my prayers go out, and I hope we will all continue to fight to get him the hell out of that place. And to Tom and to all of the others, I'm just going to close my mouth and I'm going to listen this evening. But I would like to say to your listeners that now is the time for us all to open our ears, because we live in a very, very difficult time, and it's not going to get better anytime soon. It's getting worse. So let's open our ears. I got mine open, my mouth is closed, and I will be listening. Thank you, Tom, for the presentation.
Sister Clark, I want to thank you. For those of you who are familiar with the Internet, if you Google Colia Clark, you know she is a powerhouse coming out of SNCC and an organizer with the original people who organized in Selma, and she's responsible for a lot of the legislation for voting that we now take for granted and that we are losing because we take it for granted. Brother Ralph, I want to turn it over to you, and you should know that Brother Joel Myers is in the house and ready to rock and roll as well. So, Brother Ralph.
All right. Joel, what do you think of what you've heard so far? Do you have anything new for us this week? And we're waiting for it. Let's hear it.
Yes. Hello.
How are you, Joel?
Hello. Can,
hear you. We can hear
hi,
you.
Hi. How are you, Ralph? And I want to thank you and Lynn and Betty and others who have given such wonderful leadership on this forum for having me on. And I want to say that the listening to the discussion, and we have to have a strategy. You know, I noticed during the occupation period on Wall Street, that basically people would gather, thousands of people would gather in, they call it Zuccotti Park. I call it by its old name, Liberty Plaza, because that's really what it was about. It was about people at least taking the liberty of their own mind and beginning to organize independently of the system and targeting Wall Street as something which, you know, for that number of people, for that length of time, is a something that was unprecedented. I believe even in the 30s, when there was a lot of radical organizing going on, and the Wall Street was not actually marched on or targeted or held up as the enemy or as a place that should be occupied instead of being occupied the way it is. And that was responded to after a certain period during which I believe that the rulers were encouraging some illusions of democracy. They then organized, if I'm not mistaken, it was 28 joint FBI, local police, and state police task forces across the country, all with the single goal of crushing Occupy Wall Street. And this was in spite of the I noticed during that period that a strange phenomenon was actually going on in the on the outside. They had police surrounding the park, and people in the park, protesters and people that were supporting the Occupy movement, would constantly barrage the police with many concepts. Essentially, I think it came down to how the police here are trying to rein us in and harass us and spy on us, but that the same bankers that this Occupy Wall Street movement is focusing on, these are the people that are going to come after their pensions to some degree. And a lot of them were beginning to listen. Now, I don't want to give out any illusions. I think the police are the last ones to come over. You'll get a mutiny in the armed forces before the police will come over as a normal pattern. But because the system is becoming so universally oppressive, and because more and more people are beginning to see how full of it all the political rhetoric around the system is, that even some of the police are becoming a little bit shaky. I want to limit that, though, because in all the recent police brutality episodes, the police brutality are episodes that punctuate police terror, which is steady. But even on the worst incidents of police brutality, you didn't see any police come forward and do what they're supposed to do, which is enforce the law. Like if a police officer is beating somebody, it's an assault. It's illegal, and theoretically, it's even more illegal for them because they've taken an oath. The average person has not taken an oath to obey the law and uphold the Constitution. They have, so it's even more illegal. But you don't see one police officer try to enforce against other police or even come out in public and bear witness to the fact that the police are in the wrong, contrary to what the media almost universally try to project. So, at any rate, I think we have to bear that in mind, that with certain...
That's a very important point you brought out, Joe, that there is a solid blue line. It is similar to what we heard in Germany in the 40s. My country, right or wrong, it's my organization, right or wrong, for the police. And as Sister Lynn Stewart said a long time ago, it doesn't take the whole police force to be wrong, but what it requires is the backing of the other policemen to allow corruption and death within the police department to continue. And as we see, as you have said, when do we see policemen doing their duty to support law and order coming forward saying, this policeman did a wrong act? You do not see it. You do not hear it. They do maintain their position as the army of occupation. And I'm glad you pointed out that people in America are learning. When you point out the 99%, when people realize that they are a part of the 99%, that just steps forward in education. And when people realize to come out and say, hey, there's a problem here, black lives do matter, and the police or the army of occupation are, as they do not, and they're being suspicious. And let us remember that the young man who speaks, I hear noise in the background. Somebody's here.
Okay. Brother Ralph, you're breaking up. Brother Ralph, you're breaking up.
When the police officer is indicted, he gets $1 million. Okay. Well, that's somebody's microphone is open. Okay, there it's gone. And so you see the problem, as Lynn Stewart said, doesn't take a lot of corrupt police officers. It just takes one member of the Army of Occupation to do something and the rest to support them. And let us go on. Is Ann Lamb on? Because we like to talk about political prisoners and we like to feature a political prisoner each week.
If she were on, I would have announced it. She's not on. And did you want to, before we segue into a human rights segment with Dick Minnelli, did you want to deal with this whole analysis of the Clinton Democrats and their reliance on Donald Trump to create that illusion that there is a two-party system?
Because we're running out of time. So, Rick, would you, you know, you're talking about a solution. Would you give us the part? I bet he did talk about the, some of the lines in your book.
Yeah, I know, but look, if you want to postpone it and get onto those other matters and talk about the convention, go ahead. I'll pick this up next week. I've got it in writing, so it's very easy. You know, you just we'll take that discussion into the next show.
Well, the
maybe we'll have time for it then.
The convention is a long way off, and the convention.
Okay, well then I'll proceed if you want me to.
Please do.
All right. You know that what I'm focusing on as a theoretician in politics is causes and language and all these things, and it's not always, you know, enjoyable to hear about it, and it's not immediate experience or practice. But there's some very important lessons that we can extract, as you see the nature of the word democracy and things like that, all the mistakes we made. Let me read this thing as quickly as I can. You've heard of my recent book, Human Nature, so you might wonder why, if my goal is to achieve necessary political changes, I bothered to write a book on that subject at all. The answer is simple. It's that human nature is the ultimate cause of all of our social and political problems, and that we can't solve any of those problems unless we first understand people. I give an example of it that I won't give this today, this night, okay? We can talk about it later. An important conclusion I reached in my book is that in our practical or socio-political reasoning, you remember my subtitle to Human Nature, A New Theory of Psychology, so I'm focusing on the inner workings of people, is that in our practical or socio-political reasoning, we humans are born with one of four political attitudes, and not just one of the two attitudes of the centuries-old political spectrum, leftism and rightism. So to understand people's basic political attitude, we must know not only if they are leftists or rightists, but also if they are moderates or extremists, which is also to say tolerant or intolerant of other people. Accordingly, I define conservatives as extremist rightists and liberals as moderate rightists. And I define radicals as extremist leftists and progressives as moderate leftists. This new understanding requires us now to change the meaning of the old term liberal so that now it can only mean a rightist view. We should no longer use the word liberal as if it had anything to do with leftism or in any of its old positive senses. Knowing this solves one old problem we've always had in our politics, which is that we've often had to accept some rightist political proposals by liberals just because we needed their support as moderates on important social policies. Another change in our conventional meanings is that since I define leftists as individualists and rightists as collectivists, we must now also consider socialists to be rightists and not leftists. Extreme socialism, or collectivism in general, is opposed to our leftist view that our natural individual rights must have priority in our society. I mention this for two reasons. The first is to tell you that my book proves with ample empirical evidence that on the deeper levels of reasoning, all political reasoning of the past is false and misleading. This is why all leftists must demand a new and just constitution at every opportunity. We are the only ones who will start this dialogue. Everyone else just assumes that we don't have to change our form of government to have a just society, because with patience, we can achieve this over time through our present constitution. But that is a delusion. My second reason is to define the battlefield on which everyone who wants a just and sane society finds themselves today. For instance, as my book shows, for so long as there are humans, there will always be entire generations of fundamentally impaired beings who are born with prejudicial dispositions that make them oppose or ignore moral reasoning, and who will therefore defend to the death unjust policies and practices in their own lives and in their societies. Indeed, it is just this pool of sick people who produce our society's most eager candidates for military, judicial, or law enforcement careers. The key question for us, then, is how can we moral leftists defeat these selfish and elitists who oppose justice and sanity in our societies? We can't propose to slaughter them all in endless battles, for that will only make us immoral and our world apocalyptic. The only realistic and moral way to handle this ancient unresolved problem is to create a constitution for our new society that prohibits all such immoral people from voting or holding any official position in our governments. Of course, this can't happen until we have found a reliable way to identify those people. What, many people will ask, are you seriously proposing to end democracy? Yes, I am, if you mean by that word majority rule. For if we look back through history at every case where majority rule was in effect, and this means every so-called democracy that was ever formed, including the U.S. and U.K., we find that all of those governments were pseudo-democracies that soon became oligarchies or dictatorships. But most people fail to see that, mainly because, as any good dictionary shows, our term democracy is ambiguous. That is, it has two opposite senses. The rightist sense means a type of governmental structure, one in which the rulers are elected by the majority or plurality vote of some explicitly defined class of people in the society. Those officials then decide everything in the society, including all the rights of its individuals, after which they will claim, just as they do now, that individual rights are not natural and prior to any society we form, but are merely civil rights that can be denied by their government at any time. The leftist sense of the word democracy, on the other hand, refers mainly to two fundamental principles of government that were fixed in our minds by a few great leftists in the early years of what I call the modern era, 1762 to 2008. First, that all humans are created equal, and second, that each and every individual has, to the same measure, certain natural and inalienable individual rights. The fundamentality of those two ideas, which were given concreteness by an almost impossible victory in a great revolution, made them the key political ideas of the entire modern era, global ideas that made that era politically unique and, in short order, absolutely certain to produce many further statements of individual rights that applied to all people, including slaves and women and even children, such as the United Nations list of quote-unquote human rights and children's rights. So those who want to see the first genuine democracy in history become a reality will use the word democracy only in its leftist sense. When they mean the rightist sense, they will say pseudo-democracy. And if we leftists know that our inalienable rights as individuals cannot be denied or restricted by any person, law, or collective in our society, we are not likely to object to any fair form of government that is proposed. Also, to keep our political intent clear at all times, we must not join the rightists in saying, quote, human rights, unquote, when what we mean is universal individual rights. We should also, pardon me, Betty, not use the phrase, quote, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, end quote, since this implies that it is either the full list or the primary list of our natural rights. It is neither. The true list of those rights is more extensive than any such list yet proposed. And as regards that priority, That's something that individuals must decide for themselves. So now you might ask, what is racism? On the individual level, it is an irrational attitude to others that is embraced by many people who have specific psychologic disorders, mainly impairments in their judgment process and in their social reasoning. On the societal and political levels, it is a conspiracy by just such sick and immoral people to harm, exploit, or destroy people of one or more races. The surprise, though, is that I think I have discovered an objective method for determining which people in our midst are most likely to have been born with those disorders. And so we've returned to my initial premise, which is that, like our personal problems, we can't solve any social, economic, or political problem unless we first understand human nature. Thank you for your attention.
Well, you have certainly said a mouthful, and one thing that is very clear is that there need be a change of government. And the next question is, how do we get to that change of government? And when we do change the government, to what form we use to guarantee that there is going to be a just government coming out of the change that we work to create? And I submit to you that there is no such human guarantee of government in human events. We haven't gotten to that point yet. Who is to decide who is the racist or who is the best person who will follow a religious philosophy or any other philosophy of justice that is sweet? It's quite a tall order. But in the meantime,
yes,
while we are working towards that, I say I'm going to accept the basic human right of self-defense, a right that must be exercised. It cannot be begged for. It cannot be compromised. It cannot be pushed for or to allow the oppressor to decide who has the right to self-defense. And when I say self-defense, we have to say, defending what? And as the Southerners said, they were defending the right to keep a slave. Then we have to reject when one right overrides someone else's claim. Yeah. The right must be universal and they must be extended. The one way to guarantee that is for every individual to fight for their own right to live in harmony without imposing their right on another human being. And I think that's
precisely.
As we're going to
That's the key of a morality, of course. That what is immoral is when you impose on other people, and it's imposition. And so if there is no imposition, people can coexist and they can decide their own priorities. But that list of inalienable rights is very long. What about the right to space? What about the right to privacy? What about the right to legal defense? You talk about this society that's talking about, oh, we must have unrestricted single-payer medical care. Well, you know, dealing with the question that Lynn raised earlier about lawyers getting together, we must all have unpaid or single-payer legal care. And the government shouldn't be allowed to spend $2 million trying to get some person in prison while that prisoner has nothing, or $20 or something like that, to help defend himself against the government. You know, so that's a whole matter of, you know, redefining the legal system and all of these things. I just wanted to, okay, I'm sorry, Ralph, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, that's quite all right.
Brother Ralph, I'd like to inform you, you've got about 3 to 4 minutes left. If you want your other panelists, Larry, Joel, Tom, to weigh in and give like a one-minute response, you can.
Let's save them if they can contain themselves until next week to follow up on this thing, because Mr. Minnelli has not only opened up his book to us, but he's opened up a new can of worms. But these worms must be let out and we must examine them. In fact, I think it is the issue. It is the basic issue that we must discuss because we know what the problem is and maybe we'll get closer to a solution. But I'm trying to remember the name in the last minute when somebody says, where does my freedom begin and yours end? And Holmes said at the end of the fifth, when, you know, like at the beginning of my nose. And so, yes, that's a very basic description. So let's continue this next week, Mr. Minnelli. And,
yes, we will, Ralph. You might call me and we might talk about it a little bit.
Sounds good. All right,
okay,
Betty?
All right, well, okay, you've got 3 minutes left to your program, Ralph. Larry, your mic is open. Joel, I'm going to open up your mic. And Lynn and Ralph, your mic is open. Tom, your mic is open as well.
Well, this is Tom. I find it rather difficult to accept the notion that a part of the human race is born with part of their nature is that they are mentally unstable and cannot live and given they cannot participate in society. I think that the problem here has to do with the kind of economic political system, particularly economic system, that has grown up from urbanized, so-called civilized societies, and
yeah.
In which an elite has managed, whether in ancient Rome or in feudalism or in modern-day capitalism, to rule in their own interest. That to me is where the problem is, and not that a part of the human race, the nature of these people, somehow are incapable.
Okay, on that note, Tom, I'm going to turn it over to Ralph, and he's going to take us home. And I hope that we can continue this Tuesday.
Thank you so much, Betty. Tom, a great answer to that. And we will continue because this is a very serious issue, and we must solve it while we are fighting for your strategic spoken our individual rights. When we talk about self-defense, it's certainly an individual right, and we must continue to talk about the defense of a community and those who choose to defend the community, those who choose to defend those who cannot defend themselves. And then we get into St. Augustine theory, and I'm going to let it go with that. And Betty, if you'll give us a little bit of this wonderful song and one is sleeping, I will actually see why I love it so much.
Say them loud, say them clear, for the whole.